One. Dogen wrote, "When we achieve enlightenment, it is just like the moon reflecting itself on the water. The moon will not get wet, nor is the water broken. The moonlight, however vast, reflects itself on a small quantity of water. The whole moon and the whole sky both reflect themselves, even in a dewdrop, on the grass, or in a drop of water. As the moon never breaks the water, so enlightenment never destroys the man. As the dewdrop never obstructs the reflection of the moon, so a man never obstructs the coming of enlightenment. The deeper the moon reflects itself in the water, the higher the moon is. We should realize that the long and short of time are quite one with the large and small of water and the broad and narrow of the moon."
Manisha, Dogen is making a very specific point. It deserves absolute attention and concern, because he is saying nobody obstructs your enlightenment. Then why you are not enlightened? Nobody in the whole existence is interested to become an obstacle to you. Then why you are not enlightened? It is something of major significance that has to be understood. As we go along the sutra, I would like to make it clear to you what it is that is obstructing. Certainly you are not obstructing it. The existence loves it, rejoices in it. In every man's enlightenment, the whole universe dances. One part of it, which has been groping in the dark, has come back home in the full glory. The whole existence receives him with showering of flowers. So there is no question of any obstruction from existence. And there is no question from yourself. Then who is obstructing? And there are certainly obstructions. Otherwise, there would be no need to be enlightened. You are enlightened. There would be no need for any master to tell you. It is a little bit complicated, but not so complicated that you cannot understand and overcome it. Dogen says, when we achieve enlightenment, It is just like the moon reflecting itself on the water. So peaceful, so silent. The moon reflects on the surface of the water. In fact, nothing is happening. Moon is in its own place, has not moved even a little inch towards the water. Neither the water is disturbed a little bit. But in a silent lake, the moon's reflection becomes even more beautiful than moon itself, because the lake also adds some beauty to it. It makes it more alive and more fragile. Enlightenment, according to Dzogchen, and I agree with him absolutely, is just like the moon reflecting itself on the water. There is no effort, either on the side of the water, that the moon has to be reflected. There is no commandments that have to be followed, no doctrines that have to be practiced, no yoga postures, so that the moon can reflect itself in the water. There is not even a desire, not even a longing, even a faint longing. And the same is the situation on the part of the moon. The moon has no desire to be reflected. Both are desireless, but the reflection happens on its own account. So is enlightenment. Just in a silent, peaceful consciousness, it suddenly reflects your Buddhahood. But the lake has to be silent. If there are too many ripples and too many waves on the lake, the reflection will be broken. The reflection may be broken in many parts, and you will not be able to see the moon, but only a silver line is spread all over the river. It will not be a true reflection. It will not be representative of moon. The lake, when silent and still, doing nothing, not even waving, moon reflects. Your consciousness has its own way of waving, of ripples. What are your thoughts? Except then ripples in a lake. What are your emotions, your moods, your sentiments? What is your whole mind? Just a turmoil. And because of this turmoil, you cannot see your own nature. You go on missing yourself. You meet everybody in the world, and you never meet yourself. The moon will not get wet, obviously. There is no question of the moon getting wet because he is reflected in the lake. Nor is the water broken because of the moon. Moon is not like a stone that has been thrown in the water. It is just a reflection. When you stand before a mirror, you don't disturb the mirror. You come and go. The mirror remains exactly in its position, undisturbed. The moonlight, however, must, however vast, reflects itself on a small quantity of water. The whole moon and the whole sky both reflect themselves even in a dewdrop on the grass or in a drop of water. As the moon never breaks the water, so enlightenment never destroys the man. This is a very great statement. It does not destroy the man, but it destroys the shadow of the man with which you are identified. It takes away all that is false and leaves behind only the real, the authentic, the honest. As the dewdrop never obstructs the reflection of the moon, so a man never obstructs the coming of enlightenment. The deeper the moon reflects itself in the water, the higher the moon is. We should realize that the long and short of time are quite one with the large and small of water and the broad and narrow of the moon. What is your shadow that is obstructing your reality? Your shadow has to be understood perfectly well. It is your personality. It is what you have been proposed to be. It is what you have been brought up to be. It is all those voices of your mothers and fathers, teachers, they make your personality, they create a pseudo-ness around you, your knowledge. Nobody ever asks whether it is yours. I have been expelled from many colleges for this simple reason, that the principals will call me that you cannot harass my professors. But your professor is making a statement And I had simply asked him, is it your own experience? And you call it heresy? You want me to expel, or you should expel a man who is teaching something which is not his own experience? I would tell the principal that call that teacher who has reported against me. He has to confront me. I don't care about any examination or any degree. And I don't care about your college, but things have to be put right. Even the principals will say to me that you are right, but you don't understand our problem. We are all carrying borrowed knowledge. We don't know exactly what the truth is, but we are talking about it. And you are a nuisance because nobody is asking such questions. Now, this professor that has even threatened to resign if I am not expelled immediately from the college has been our old, very senior man, almost near his retirement, and he has never been violent or angry. There is nothing against him during his 20 years service in the college, and suddenly you have made him almost insane. He has not come for 3 days. He has closed his doors. He does not want to speak to anybody from college. He does not answer the phone. He has simply written a note that unless you expel that student, I am not going to come to college. I said, there is no problem. I can expel your whole college. You need not be worried about that. But I will follow that man, college or no college. I know his home. I may not be a student in your college, that does not mean where he is going to live. I will knock on his doors. Either he has to recognize the fact that his knowledge is borrowed, or he has to say honestly, I simply want to provoke him. I was surprised to know that great professors, because I have been in many colleges, this was a great opportunity. Otherwise, one ends up with one college. I was being expelled from one college to another, and finally from one university to another university. And the Second university accepted me with condition that I will not trouble the professors. I said, what kind of poverty? If you don't know the answer, simply you can say, I don't know. But your ego is hurt. They asked me to write down that they are accepting me on the condition that I will not attend any classes. It's strange. I don't think this may have happened to anybody's in the whole world. If I am not to attend the classes, then for what you are admitting me? And how I am going to manage my percentage of attendance to appear in the examination? And the Vice Chancellor said, I will take care of your percentage. You are present, 100%. That is my promise to you. But please don't go to any class. Because I have heard about you so much from very old professors, principals, the other vice chancellor who has expelled you phoned me that beware of this boy. I'm accepting you because I can see the point that you are not wrong, just our whole system is wrong. Your only fault is that you are pointing to our wounds. I can understand you. That's why I am giving you admission. But the professors will not be able to understand. You are so accurate in hitting at the weakest point that these ordinary professors, after all, they are just serving for money. There is no question of truth or good or beauty. They are not concerned about these things. They are concerned with their pays. They are concerned with their salaries. They are concerned with their position. There is a politics. The lecturer wants to be the reader wants to be the professor wants to be the head of the department wants to be the dean of the faculty, the deans want to be the vice chancellors. Nobody is interested in what you are asking. Your presence has become a fear. I had to accept this, but I told him as I signed the agreement and he signed my admittance, I told him that I can at least meet the professors on the road. I can knock on their doors. The promise is only for the classes. I can go to the library. These things are not included. He said, this is difficult. And I used to do that, knock on professors' doors, and they will say, just leave us at peace. We are tired. The questions that you ask are unanswerable. Because we don't know, we are not seekers. We are just educationalists. We have learned from others who have learned from others. Nobody knows what we are teaching, whether it is true, or we are simply repeating superstitions. I will catch hold of them in the library. And the Vice Chancellor told me that, look, although it is not part of our agreement, so I cannot insist it, but don't harass. You prevent professors on the road when they are coming to their classes, and you ask them that, please answer this question before you enter the class, because I cannot enter the classroom. But I can stand outside the classroom. And from the window I will shout the question. So it is better, let us settle it here. I will never enter the classroom. But this is no more part of the agreement. The Vice Chancellor has forgotten that every class has a window. I can stand outside in fresh air rather than in the rotten inside air. And I can ask anything that I want. And you should understand it clearly, that when I ask a question, and if you don't answer it, the whole class will ask the same question. It is not part of the agreement. I used to distribute the question to all the class, that if he does not answer me, one by one you stand up and ask the question. Until he is finished, but who is preventing all these people who are knowledgeable not to see that their very knowledge is the barrier? Dozen is right that enlightenment is your natural being. So natural, just as the moon reflecting in the silent lake. No effort on any side. No desire on any side. It is a happening. But you have not been left a clean, silent lake. So much rubbish in the name of religion, in the name of politics, in the name of society has been imposed on you. That is what is making the barrier. And the poor moon cannot reflect in you. you have to destroy this whole wall. Even very intelligent people, I have seen behave so superstitiously. You cannot believe. There are countries where number 13 is thought to be a dangerous number. Perhaps somebody died and committed suicide on 13th, some time back. Perhaps somebody jumped from the 13th floor of a hotel. And now it has become a certainty to people. There are hotels which don't have 13 number room. After 12 jumps the 14th. They don't have the 13th floor. After 12th just comes the 14th. It is 13th, but the hotel does not recognize it as 13th. People don't get married on 13th out of fear that life will be a misery. And they don't look around that whether you marry on 13th or 14th or 15th, marriage is going to be a misery. Don't blame the dates. And don't blame the days. Marriage itself is a desire to be miserable. A deep down desire. A partnership in miserableness. That you miserable. You look so beautiful means you look so miserable. I am also very miserable. Let us be together. As if by being together, the misery will disappear. It will be not only doubled, it will be multiplied. And the whole world knows it. But we will go on continuing the conditioning. If you are unmarried, every married person you know is very much sorry for you. That poor fellow. He has remained a bachelor. He does not know the happinesses of misery. When I came back from the university, naturally my parents were concerned that I should get married, but they were afraid even to ask me because they knew once I say no, then it is forever. Then there is no way to drag me to say yes. And they knew me perfectly well that it is absolutely improbable that I will say yes. So how to ask, that was the problem. And I told them that it seems everybody wants something to ask me. And I am ready. But why you don't ask it? You whisper with each other. Finally, my father found an advocate, thinking that he is a Supreme Court advocate, a very successful man in his profession. He asks him that we are not in a position even to ask. Now you have to do something. He said, don't be worried. The whole country knows that when I take a case in my hand, my father said that it is not the Supreme Court and this is no ordinary case. I warn you, if any trouble arises for you, I will not be responsible. He said, what trouble? I'm coming this weekend and I will talk to your son and I will see how he can manage. It is a question of argumentation. My father said, you don't know him, but come. We will all enjoy it. So everybody was ready. He came. I touched his feet because he was my father's friend and I was as respectful as always. And I asked him before the debate starts. He said, what debate? I said, you know it, I know it, and everybody else present here knows it. But before it starts, I want you honestly to be one question. That are you satisfied in your marriage? I have informed your wife. And if you say anything wrong, she is just sitting in the other room. He said, what? She is here? My God, I don't want to be entangled in this affair. I said, it has not even started. He said, I don't want to take the case. I said, this is not the court. And you had come with such a wide chest and now you have suddenly become a rat. I will have to wash my hands. I touched your feet. And it was only a fiction. I have not asked his wife. But I knew that she beats him. He said, your father asked me. I said, I'm perfectly ready. If you can convince me that marriage is the right way of living, I will get married. But if you fail in convincing me, you will have to divorce. He said, my God, your father was right. That this is a difficult case. I simply withdraw. I don't want to say a single word. Let me think. Next week I will come. He never came. But every week I would go to his home and his wife will ask me, what is the matter? Whenever you come, he hides himself in the bathroom. And I will knock on the bathroom and he will say, no, I cannot come out right now. Why don't you leave me alone? I have become so afraid of you, I cannot go to the market because who knows, you may stop me in the street and start the debate. And I cannot afford. The wife said, but what is the matter? Why you are so afraid? I said, either you come out or I am going to tell your wife. He immediately came out. He said, just forgive me. For God's sake, just drop the matter. I will never mention to you or anybody. The wife said, but what is the matter that you are so much afraid? You perspire and it is air conditioned. And you hide and you tell me to lie that you are not at home. And he is such a stubborn person, he goes on coming. I said, this is the problem. You have to be the judge. This man, your husband, wants me to get married. What is your opinion? He said, married? If you want to be miserable, get married. Just look at this man. I have been reforming him since the day we married. I have almost finished him. He fights in the Supreme Court as a lion, and in the house he is just an stray dog. Even children understand it. Even children blackmail him. That you give 5 rupees, otherwise we will tell the mother. And he cannot even ask what it is that they will tell the mother. Just this was enough, that you have been talking to the neighbor's wife so sweetly. And then the wife was really dangerous. He will beat him. Now the poor fellow is dead. And I have told my parents and my family that don't bring others unnecessarily. Because I am fundamentally against marriage. It is not a question of my marrying. It is something fundamental to me that marriage is a wrong conception. Two persons can be in love and live together. And the moment their love disappears, as everything disappears in this world, they should depart with gratitude to each other, with friendship, with memories of the past days. Marriage is absolutely unnatural. That's why you don't see any animals in the psychiatric hospitals. You don't see them lying on the psychoanalyst's couch. They don't go mad. But man has been imposed by so many layers about everything that he thinks as if they are his thoughts. A seeker has to discriminate very carefully what is yours and what has been given to you. And the moment you start sorting out, you will be amazed to know that you don't have anything of your own. You are just a silent lake. And in that silent lake, your Buddhahood arises. Your nature is in its purity, in its splendor, in its blissfulness. Neither anybody is trying to prevent you from becoming enlightened. Those people, those teachers, those parents, they were not aware, they were as unconscious. They were also victims of their parents, of their teachers, of their rabbis and their pandits and their Shankaracharyas and their popes. They were victims and they have given in heritage all their suffering and all their misery to you. Now you have to put all that load aside. Buddhahood is your natural self. Just put everything that is not arising within you, flowering within you, in a way, in the beginning you will feel poor. All your knowledge is gone, all your superstitions are gone, your religions are gone, your political ideologies are gone. You will feel very much poor. But this poverty is of tremendous value, because only in this poverty arises your natural richness, your natural flowers, your natural ecstasies. The natural man is not destroyed by enlightenment, but you are not natural. You are polluted. And everybody is harming everybody else by giving conditions. In a better society, children will not be taught any religion, any politics. They will be taught how to think, how to doubt, not how to believe. They will be taught to be more intelligent, to be more reflective, and the whole world will be full of enlightened people. Enlightenment is just your naturalness. This is the great contribution of Zen. All other religions are belief systems. Zen is not. All other religions will ask you to believe in God, in heaven, in hell. All other religions will have 1001 beliefs. Zen has no belief system. Its whole effort is to discover your natural self, which is covered with dust of all kinds of good intentions, of beautiful thoughts, of great beliefs, all that dust has to be cleaned off. And when you are left alone in your naturalness, a haiku of Hoetsu, Buddha, cherry flowers in moonlight. Just so simple. Just so beautiful. Buddha, cherry flowers in moonlight. Ryoto wrote so brilliant a moon sign, if ever I am born again, a hilltop pine. He is asking that if he is going to be born again, he would like to be a hilltop pine. Such a beautiful moon, hanging with the hilltop pine. These people are not ordinary poets. They are expressing an authentic longing to be natural, peaceful, to be silent. A hilltop pine. Because mankind seems to be so insane. Another Zen poet, searching for him, took my strength. One night I bent my pointing finger, never such a move. These people are natural poets. They have dropped all ideologies. They have started having relationships with pine trees and the clouds and the lightnings in the hills, with the rivers, with the ocean. They have dropped out of the human world, which is absolutely false, and they have regained again their roots in nature. This is, in my vision, the only religion in the world worth calling religion. All religions are just exploitations of man and his search for himself. They are deviations distractions. They lead you away from yourself. They don't bring you home. Manisha has asked, Dozen seems to be saying that the more profoundly enlightenment touches one's being, the more potent is the enlightenment. Is it true that there are no grades of enlightenment, that one is either enlightened or not, but the enlightenment, like wine, becomes more and more mature? Manisha, your understanding is right. There are no grades of enlightenment. Either you are enlightened or not enlightened. But certainly, as enlightenment deepens, matures, reaches to your very roots, it is just the right symbol, like the wine. Older it is, the better. There are wine collectors. You can find 300-year-old wine, 400-year-old wine. They are all wines. Fresh wine just produced from the garden is also vine, but a 300-year-old vine has attained a certain quality of intensity, density, which is lacking in the new arrivals. There are experts in the world who can tell exactly, just by taking a sip, that how old is the wine. It happened in a pub that a man said to the bartender that here are $100. If you are ready to gamble with me, I will taste any wine you want me to taste. And I will tell you exact year and month. It was unbelievable, because it is very fine art. The offer was accepted, that on each time he tells the right date, the right year when the wine was made, the shopkeeper will be losing $100. And he went on tasting and telling exactly the date, year. It was so amazing, all the drinkers and drunkards who were there sitting on different benches, gathered around, even who were drunk completely became awake that what is happening. And the man was amazing. And then suddenly a man from the back said that I also want to join in the contest, because I have got a wine. If you can tell me so he brought a cup full of wine. The man tasted and spit, and he said, you idiot, this is human urine. But the man said, whose? I know it is human urine, but whose? Unless you tell whose, you are not a great taster. Enlightenment certainly has no grades, but it deepens, sharpens, matures, becomes more and more richer as time passes. Before we enter into our daily meditation, the bamboos are so silent, just waiting for your laughter. And remember one thing, when you laugh, just don't laugh for conformity. Secondly, when you laugh, laugh totally, without any considerations. Don't hold anything back. Learn to laugh from Sardayal and Gurdayal ki. Who is a laugh unto himself, a real joke, because he is the only man in the whole world I have come across who laughs before the joke. There are people who laugh in the middle of the joke, because they suddenly remember that what is going to happen. But from the very beginning, when I have not even started, that is the real and authentic man of laughter. Just, and I know he has his disciples. He is a very respected old sannyasin. People sit around him just to have a good laugh. Joe is speak easy. The successful liar is married to a woman who nags him constantly. She nags him about his appearance, about how much he drinks, about how little he loves her, about almost everything. So Joe starts staying later at his office to avoid her. One day, after weeks of defending a client called William Wright, who is on trial for murder, Joe comes home very depressed. He has lost the case, and Wright is to be executed that night unless the governor pardons him. As Joe enters the house, his wife begins, "Where you have been? It is after 10 o'clock. Ah, nag, nag, nag." He says in disgust and goes to pour himself a drink. "The minute you come home," he snaps his wife, "you start drinking. Not even a hello for me." "Ah, nag, nag, nag," sighs Joe. Then he goes upstairs for a bath, telling his wife that he is expecting a phone call from the governor. While he is in the bath, the call comes. Wright has been pardoned. Joe's wife decides to tell him the good news herself. As she enters the bathroom, Joe is standing naked, bending over the tub. "Hey, Joe," says his wife, "they are not hanging right tonight." Joe snaps back, "Ah, nag, nag, nag." The backwoods Virginia farmer has been screwing one of his favorite pigs for years. Suddenly, Zabe is hit by pangs of guilt and conscience that torture him so much, he decides to go and tell the priest about it in confession. Father Fungus is shocked and he really does not know how to handle this one. Well, says the priest to old Zeb, tell me, is the pig male or female? She is female, of course. It's not Zeb. What do you think I am? Some kind of a pervert? Pope the Pollock is sitting on the train next to Ronald Reagan on their way back to Washington from Kill Jews, Alabama. The Pope strikes up a conversation with two big black guys, Rufus and Leroy, in compartment. Hello, gentlemen, says the Pope. Where are you going? DC, says Rufus. What did he say? Asked the slightly deaf president. He says they are going to Washington, DC, just like us, says the Pope. Tell me, the Pollock continues, what brings you all the way up to Washington? We know a real far out chick up there, smiles Leroy. What did he say? Asked the hard of hearing Ronnie. He says they have a girlfriend up there, shouts back the Pope to the president. Then turning to the black guys, Pope the Pollock says, she must be quite a girl for you to go all this way to see her. Man, I say, smiles Rufus. Sure, says Leroy, she is a real cool bitch. She wears black boots with spurs, carries a whip, and indulges in every delight known to man. What did he say? Shouts the deaf president. Pope the Pollock turns to Ronnie and screams, he says they know Nancy. Nevedanam.